Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by a very special guest. Paul, it's been too long since we've done this. Paul Rabel, co-founder, CSO? CMO?
President.
President.
Yeah, I've played actually lacrosse in both of those titles. Yeah.
Gotta stay current. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, a big couple weeks in the PLL history. You recently announced the transition to home markets, home cities. The PLL is coming home, and we're going to talk about that. But first, for me, that's a 2024 story. I want to talk about 2023. Let's just look back a little bit. But in order to do that, I want to provide the context of year five, right? So year one, you launch. It's year one. There's a lot that goes into it, but ultimately it needs to be summarized by year one. Year two, January 1st, you announced expansion, Water Dogs. That was, in some respects, going to be the story of the year. It turned out that a pandemic and a bubble in Harriman, Utah was kind of the story of year two. Year three, it was a combination of first year back from COVID, right back on the road. Obviously, the merger in December of 2020 with the MLL and then expanding to eight teams. That was kind of the story of that. There was a lot going on in 2021. And then I'm sure that there are a lot of things in 22 that you could use to kind of summarize the season. But for me, it was the transition to ESPN, the first year of the ESPN deal. In that, if you're going to try to summarize it or boil it down to that level of you know, kind of conciseness, what was year five? What was 23 about?
Wow. I think growth for us and having the first stable year that we've had as an organization. I mean, you so well described our timeline to this point. 2019, we were in competition. 2020, we were in a pandemic. 2021, there was still social distancing, and we were meeting with our ticketing team all the way through the summer on any updates related to how many people could sit next to each other.
I remember in Baltimore, they changed the rule that week, and they gave you like an additional 2,500 tickets on like Monday.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been a rocky road. But we are clearly passionate about building pro lacrosse. We're clearly ambitious about where we want to go. And I think 2023, to me, was about growth and really about setting up for the future of growth at the PLL with our network partner and ESPN internationally. You know, we got back to Japan, for example, in the off season, and we were there in the off season of our first year. So the startup experiment is also maybe worth calling out in that not only your strategies and your tactics evolve, but your emotion has to take shape, mature in a lot of ways. And you know, the way that you allocate resources gets more and more important. But I would say that, you know, through year five too, important for the sports industry to know that we're still here and we're here and thriving. And that's an important piece because most leagues that have started since 1990 have failed. Only 1% have made it past 3 years. So that's really exciting for us. So now we're like, okay, great. Time to turn on geographies. Time to commercialize this thing.
So for me, there were four things that kind of stood out, and I want to work through them. So the first is about 23 in specific. The first was the championship series. And you can make an argument that was a little bit of a 22 story because obviously you announced it.
Right.
You know, set the standings. But we didn't see it until February. And I've said this to you multiple times since. I don't know for sure that it's the best thing the PLL has done, but it is definitely in the conversation.
Yeah.
I think the
shit, I should have said that then when you asked me. Championship series.
Yeah, there you go. But no, I think that, you know, it did so many things. So the first thing is obviously it expanded your calendar. The second thing was that it put Sixes on a stage that it had never otherwise been.
Yeah.
The third thing is that it PLLified Sixes by adding a 2-point line.
Yeah.
And created like all this new manner of the way in which you can play the game, and you know, just the fact that Romar Dennis is a star in that format is like, so I called it a lacrosse laboratory. Sixes, I got the opportunity to go to Birmingham for the World Championship or the World Games in the summer of 22, and I was like, this is historic in the way that it's like the making of a sport. It was really cool. And anybody who actually ardently cares and genuinely cares about the sport can imagine that being like being on a playground, right? Legitimately, because it's almost like playground lacrosse. But then the last thing is, well, it's kind of a two-part thing. It looks so good on TV because the field is smaller.
Yeah.
And it felt so vibrant in the room. A, because it's warm. It's not it's February and you're not freezing on a sideline or in stands.
Yeah.
B, you guys did such a nice job with the elevated stands on one side, the bar down on one end, the more family-friendly experience on the other end, and then the hospitality on the far sideline. It was just so well constructed.
Yeah.
Championship series.
Yeah, thanks for teeing that up. I mean, you said it better than I will. I would add, perhaps, I like that lacrosse laboratory. It was a huge information opportunity for us to learn about the game, both from a data and an output, but from an imagination standpoint. So there's the data tied to it, and then there's the path to the Olympics. Where a requisite for LA 28 was to actually see the product. You know, we, in many ways, invented this version of lacrosse, much like how, you know, George Beers invented 10-on-10 lacrosse, and, you know, people often debate the traditions of field lacrosse, and, you know, the traditions are the Native American traditions, which was most of the time ceremonial, and that is when you call it the medicine game. So it was played before the longhouse, and then recreational, and that at times, you know, featured hundreds of players per side and no time limits, no rules, no boundaries, played between elders and younger, and you're an elder if you have offspring. So the game is meant to be shared, as Lyle Thompson would tell me, and stands the test of time and is evolving. And so going back to why it helped us get into the Olympics is this version of the game needed to be played and played by the best. So it was a initial bet that we had to make as stewards of the game's growth internationally to say, all right, if we're going to do this offseason tournament, let's do it sixes. Really critical time right now as we continue our bid to the Olympics. And then if we get in, by the way, we have a backstop of knowing that we were early and it's a property that stands the chance of really growing. I got a couple of calls from two prominent ESPN executives in the middle of the tournament. And we're like, so what are you thinking? Right? In other words, they loved it. And, you know, there's a Scott O'Neill saying that you have to keep the main thing the main thing. And they were basically like, is this going to become the main thing? And you have to listen to your network executives.
For sure.
Here's for every lacrosse fan. We will continue to have 10-on-10, and we will continue to grow 6-on-6. Those schedules both could expand over time, or one could slightly contract and the other slightly expand. That's the stuff that our forecasting team, you know, is looking at on a day-to-day. But it's pretty cool. I love the idea, actually, of having these properties live on the counter sides of the calendar, both be in their own rights unique to the game, both feature different players that can emerge themselves as stars, and both ultimately lead to greater attention and greater interest in lacrosse.
Moving it forward, I think one of the other elements of the 2023 year that will be kind of a memory is the international break and the world championships that occurred, which obviously isn't a PLL story, but affected the PLL season. How do you kind of put that into context, realizing, you know, what it did for the PLL and its business, and then also, you know, for what it means for future iterations of international lacrosse?
Well, it's really complicated. Let me also, because this, I mean, by the way, I never get to say, like, it's so great to sit here with you. We do this
once every 2 years.
We used to do it multiple times a year. And now it's probably like, I'm sure you are, like everyone else, sick of me. But I love to have these conversations with you because they inevitably go off in different directions. So this is a complicated one because lacrosse is complicated. We just talked about the rules and different rules between field and sixes, and then you have box. We should have different standards for youth as well. But that's a separate conversation. When we launched the PLL, people forget that MLL was playing in the middle of April. And so as a former MLL and NLL player, I started in 2008 with the San Jose Stealth and the Boston Cannons. Quickly, or after in the second year, the San Jose Stealth became the Washington Stealth, and we were playing in the championship. It was a two-week overlap at the time because MLL would start in May and NLL would end the regular season in April.
Mid-April, yeah.
That quickly, over the next 5 years, became an eight-week potential overlap. And that was just crazy to me. So when we launched the PLL, we started June 1st, largely because of that reason. We also wanted to mind the transition from great college players that are finishing on Memorial Day, are drafted, and have a clean start with their pro team. My personal experience as well, getting drafted over to the Cannons, I played, my first game was week six, you know, and that, like, was hard. I wish I was there for week one. The third piece is, okay, we have to take care of the pro game, and part of growing your business in sports is having what networks call tonnage. This is number of games, number of hours per game, and they a lot of times evaluate your media rights proposition based on your total tonnage. It's traditionally why Major League Baseball plays so many games and why the NBA plays so many games. It's starting to change. Let's leave NFL aside because they're a bit of an anomaly. But you try to expand to create more value, more commercial enterprise value. And so on the other side of August is football season. And that's hard. Yeah. But we've got to play. We've got to have tonnage so we can build this thing. So we've always been in a difficult spot starting in June, ending mid-September. You layer on our first network deal with NBC where the goal is to get as much broadcast inventory as possible. They had cable when we launched with NBC Sports. Now they put some of their sports properties on USA, which is a cable property, but it's mainly broadcast and Peacock. When we transition over to ESPN, the same strategy. I mean, ESPN is cable and the most valuable cable channel. So we view broadcast, cable, and streaming as the strategy with our new network partner. But when they give you windows in September, which, you know, ABC has strong propositions because they don't carry NFL games. And same thing with NBC that had Sunday night football. So you get these opportunities in September and you just, you, instead of looking at it as like the lesser of two evils, I look at it as an opportunity to continue to grow our profile and gather attention. I say all that because I totally understand where everyone comes from that gives us feedback, whether it's fans or sports commentators and such, that, hey, look, it's not ideal. There's a reason why there's inventory available in the summer for pro sports leagues, because families are out on vacation and it's beautiful weather and like people want to stay away from the summer. But you have to build something from scratch in a very meticulous way, in an opportunistic way. Do I believe that spring might be the best for the PLL? Historically, MLL data would suggest it is. But we've got to continue to thread the needle and work with NLL on their schedule and figure out what's best for college players and their transition, and try to time it out. Because right now, you know, while our wages have significantly grown since when I was playing, my estimation is that our wages aren't at a place yet where, you know, one way to think about it is, would Brendan O'Neill leave college early to come play for us? That's where you need to get the wages up to, and you stage it out. But we're growing this thing commercially from a revenue standpoint, from an attention standpoint, such that on parallel, players can make more money playing professional lacrosse.
Shifting the focus on the field.
Sorry, that was a lot.
No, it was great. It was great. And I think that the answer is, if you play in the spring, you don't have as many disruptive windows, right? You know, specifically when talking about, like,
depends on the network, right?
Well,
so ESPN has the NBA, but they lost MLS.
I'm talking about with respect to players' availability.
Players' availability, right, yeah. Exactly, because you have a lot of pros who coach.
Right.
They coach in the spring, they coach high school, they coach college.
Right.
then you have the college player availability. Yeah.
Right. Shifting the focus on the field, I think the you know, there's a ton, obviously. You played, you know, 14 weeks of action, and there were new stars that emerged and everything else. But I thought that, again, kind of in a way that, like, Sixes was a lacrosse laboratory, the way that the PLL product continues to evolve, I thought that the most interesting development was the way the coaches handled the 32-second shot clock rule. And what is your kind of, like, reaction, kind of backward-looking view, and what is your forward-looking view on that rule?
Yeah, well, it's all sort of tied together so far of what we discussed. So championship series, is, you know, as you mentioned, that laboratory to learn. You see the pace of the game, the excitement, the chances, the timing, the feedback, and you go, okay, what have we learned here that we can apply to the 10-on-10 game? And then you study the history of other sports, where I spent a lot of time thinking about the NBA, and they went from no shot clock to 24 seconds, and they stayed at 24. And they committed to the 24-second shot clock for 5 years, which in hindsight, it was something that we didn't do that I would have liked to have done, which is like set a, and even the NCAA has this, when they put a new rule in, they mandate it has to be there for 2 years. Because people have to learn, they have to adapt, and they grow into it. And that's what humans, especially athletes, do so well. So the 24-second clock in the NBA was catastrophic for the coaches and players. They hated it. So, like, we can't even get our motion offense through two cycles. And eventually, it changed. When I look at the NBA now, or even watch the WNBA, I can feel the forcing mechanism that a 24-second and on an offensive rebound, the 14-second clock gives. Now, is basketball the same as lacrosse? No. It would be more close to lacrosse if they allowed goaltending, which I think is the ultimate differentiator, right? Steph Curry can do a step back with the clock going and get a shot off, and it's a decent shot. But you can't step back from your defender at 17 and expect you're going to score on Blaise Redden. But it was a great case study to understand the thoughtfulness and approach of evolving the game of basketball, increasing the attention and the excitement and thereby the viewership and commercial opportunity of it, and the patience of allowing coaches and players to do what they do best, which is evolve. When we thought about the face-off, and I live it and I love it, is that the first reaction is, well, why don't you change the rules for Blaise Redden, who's dominant as a goalie? Why don't you change the rules for Tom Schreiber? He can only shoot, you know, 10 seconds left in the clock outside of 15, right? And the difference to me for face-off players and other positions on the field is they uniquely and very kingly determine possession. And it's the only sport, if you look at basketball, baseball, soccer, it's equal possession. Even when we play ping pong downstairs or backyard hoops, it's, you know, win by two, there are rebuttals. Possession is at our foundation of fair play. And lacrosse uniquely, especially as the faceoff position has evolved, if tipping the scales and winning a disproportionate amount, you're essentially putting the other team in a stranglehold. And so while respecting the position, trying to continue to build as much excitement around it, we wanted to thread the needle of lessening the possession imbalance, the weight of that, over the course of a game, if when you win, you have a shorter clock. Now, the question then is how, you know, is 32 too fast? Is it 35? Is it 38? And, you know, we don't have enough data or tests to know, like, what the sweet spot is. But there are some things that we want to address and will address into this coming season. I think, you know, again, giving credit to coaches and players that their job is to adapt. I thought Brian Holman's strategy was good, you know, in that he didn't have what he felt was a top faceoff guy to contend and win first possessions. He also had a fantastic defense. It reminded me of the 2015 Boston Cannons defense that almost scored, or the 2001 Baltimore Ravens were more confident coming out of their defensive end and scoring in transition and then we're out of a clean 6-on-6 set. And
they were also great coaching, super efficient in the 32, and it's because they were an attack-oriented offense, and you could give the ball to Asher, and he could inside roll,
yeah.
And that's an end-of-shot clock play that was way more efficient than what most other teams had.
Yeah.
So to your point about adjusting, it's not just about the face-off personnel situation. It's also about your offensive personnel situation and how you're going to prepare to take advantage of a 32-second shot clock in the event that you win.
Totally. And so if you study what the Cannons were doing, they were putting a pole at the stripe. They were standing up and defending right away, and they had both of their D-middies in. So you eliminate the 30-yard sprint substitution, which empties out 5% of your tank for that shift, sometimes 10%. So you're basically, you know, if you're Bubba Fairman, you're starting on the wing, and then you sort of shuffle in. So you're full battery. You get a stop, or you start pressuring. You get a stop, and you blow the doors off in transition. They're really good at that. So I thought, I didn't think there was enough discussion on it. Credit to them. What I don't like, what I saw exposed the rules, is that, you know, and one of the reasons why we kept long poles at the stripe is you have the CJ Costabiles of the world, you know, the Eli Gobrecks, like guys that can win draws with their pole. It's exciting. But what we didn't think about was the pressure on a faceoff player if they have the ball on their stick with a pole on their hands immediately. It would be like, every shift, me coming out of the box and a long pole waiting for you there. It's just, you know, a challenge. So we're looking at sort of the personnel, much like how a goalie stick has to start in the crease by rule. You know, we're looking at ways to, you know, really assessing every part of the draw and just improve on, I thought, a lot of progress from last year.
Last one about 23 is, I do think that there's a pretty substantial difference between year one of not playing and year two of not playing. And that was the difference between 22 and 23. What was it like for you to be another year removed from not playing and being an executive?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's because you love the game, and I miss the game, and I still feel like I could play and have an impact. But the opportunity that we get, I'm looking at you two as executives in the sport, and the service of it is pretty amazing. And it's really hard to do both. And it was emotionally really taxing on me. And I've had two knee surgeries since retiring. Like, I beat my body to shit. I'm going to go see Jay Dyer here and go through like an annual turkey trot with him because I miss him. And, you know, he groomed me for 20 years, but we basically have no cartilage left in my right knee. I had foot surgery twice, back challenges, two tears in both shoulders, sports hernia surgery, adductor surgery. Like, my body was beat to shit. And I know that I feel it now. Like, I sort of crack and creak when I get out of bed, and I'm sure I'll feel it even more when I'm 50. I think, you know, protecting myself a little bit there and trying to take my own advice of sort of reading the room.
Were you more at peace this year, or was it equivalent? Or were you less? Did you feel more of an itch?
You know, 2022 was really hard. So I would say I felt more at peace this year. Yeah. And, I mean, I was glued to my seat during the championship series. That's the other thing you sort of like know when it comes to sport or product, when something's really great and has a lot of opportunity, is if you are excited to get into your seat during warmups, you know. And that's how I was feeling at the St. James. I just couldn't wait for the game. So cool. Yeah, my time has passed, Terry.
All right. Cities.
Yeah.
Home markets. You said that it was the biggest investment the PLL made in the sport since forming the PLL. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when we launched the PLL, we knew that a touring model would be effective, both from a balance sheet of capital, but also a supply demand of, and we're still not quite sure how many people play lacrosse every year. You know, we know that there are way more fans of lacrosse, but participants like hockey, like golf, there's just barriers to get into the game. It's expensive to play. We still have a shortage of coaching nationally, certainly not in the Northeast, but nationally. And then access to goals and fields. So, you know, that supply-demand piece was pretty critical. Now, we felt like with six teams, because you did in your intro, the expansion of seven in year two and the expansion of eight in year three, we felt like with six teams, putting them into cities would have been pretty daring, because there's a lot we didn't know. And we really wanted to win over the lacrosse fan no matter where they were. And so then it becomes a question of when should you do that? Because the data is overwhelming. If we want to capture the 100 million casual sports fans in the U.S. and they don't watch lacrosse, therefore they don't know who the best players are, therefore their entry point is different than lacrosse fans who watch lacrosse and know who the best players are. So it's got to then be by the second entry point, which is your hometown team or where your parents are from or where you live. Now, you just can't slap cities on teams and maintain touring model and expect that it's going to work. And, you know, interestingly and maybe pleasantly, we haven't gotten that level of feedback. It's like, well, nothing's changed. And I hope that's because people trust that when we say we're resourcing and investing in these communities, we are. I mean, we think about a hometown weekend is a doubleheader for the team, say the Boston Cannons. They play on Saturday and Sunday, and they might not be back to Boston that season. So you're talking about 2 + 363. So what are we doing the other 363 days of the year? We have players in market. We're working with local Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, all the as many of the local rec and even club programs. So call it youth participation. We're doing local partnership deals. We are making sure we're getting our athletes to events from a PR standpoint. We really want the community to feel like the Cannons are in Boston. And so that's all investment. And the other side of it was the psychological bet that we were going to pick the right markets for the PLL right now, that had the most upside, that our fans mostly told us they wanted to be in. That viewership and ticket sales attributed to. And that was extraordinarily difficult because there are some big openings, right? Florida, Texas, the Midwest, Pacific Northwest come to mind for me. Those are all really important markets to us. And each of them presented their own challenges. We can talk about that,
Well, yeah. Let's go through the choices that you did make first, and then we can hit a couple. You already mentioned the Cannons, and I think that's kind of a no-brainer. I don't want to say there's nothing else to say, but I don't know if there's anything else to say about it.
Well, I would say that the challenge for and has been for Boston is venue. We play at Gillette. The Cannons used to play at Harvard. Harvard's still really big. It's like 40,000 seats or something. BU's interesting. But, you know, you want to ideally find a venue that is – been refurbished, modernized, great experience for fans and players, and, you know, 10,000 seats, call it. So that's the challenge for Boston, and our ops team's working through it now. So not one market is clean, but let's keep going through the list.
Well, so this one is a little bit more of a glint, as kind of a twist, so to speak. Maryland Whipsnakes, probably roughly equivalent of a no-brainer. Is it going to be tough? Well, so first of all, I guess you already brought up the issue of you know, market does not equal venue. So I'm making an assumption that Homewood will be the Maryland market. I am sure that you are going to play an event in Homewood because it has been so successful over the course of the history of the PLL. But you could play twice in Maryland, and the Homewood event could be one of the other two regular season games or the All-Star game or one of the three postseason weekends.
Exactly.
So are you willing to confirm on this podcast that the Maryland Whipsnakes will play their home game at Homewood, or is that not yet a decision that's been made?
Well, it's pretty close to it. I would say that you're on the right track, similar to the Cannons having to be in Boston. But, you know, our attempt at the Maryland Whipsnakes, look, we could have put a team in D.C. and Baltimore and Annapolis. Yeah. The numbers in each of those markets are top top 15 in the country. We also were presented a really unique opportunity to get creative. You know, it's the official team sport of Maryland. There's not another team sports league that encompasses or embodies Baltimore to the DMV corridor, which, by the way, can lean towards Northern Virginia all the way out to the Chesapeake Bay. And we know that Annapolis is a huge fan base. So we wanted to, like, sort of build that community. Even, you know, I grew up in playing in the WCAC, and then you have IAC, and you have warfare with the MIA, and like, who's better? Well, this team can actually, through a lot of ways, bring that state together, which is really exciting. You know, stepping back, though, to that point is a lot of debate we had internally was region versus city. And, you know, the state sits in between, right? New York is almost a region in and of itself, certainly California. But they're also states, and in New York's case, you know, it's also a city. But history will tell us that if you try to boil the ocean, if you go regions, that it hasn't worked in the past. It also tells us that, much like the music business, for an artist coming up, you have to dominate your neighborhood, then you move out and dominate your city, then your state, then the country, then you go international. And if you look at the Premier League over in the UK, most of the teams that have global recognition and globally commercialized their teams as well, you know, are these like 2.5 square mile neighborhoods. So, you know, we were really I don't want to say tempted, but we were really thinking about being as acute as possible. So I think that was the other side of, hey, why not a team in the Midwest? Well, the fans of Chicago gave us plenty of feedback in our first year that SeatGeek Stadium was too far off the beaten path. So that stadium was a challenge. And then we've struggled finding other venues that fit our schedule in Chicago. We love Chicago. It's a great market. Minnesota is also a great market. I don't believe that Midwest is a great team name.
It's not.
Yeah. And we asked the fans of the Midwest. We did loads of surveys. So that was, you know, that way, and you can speak to that, right? And we've had a great, by the way, we've had a great successive, you know, weekends of success in Ohio. Ohio also borders Pennsylvania, you know? And so if we want to play the map game, like, you know, it's just, it's hard.
Yeah.
But I will say, last thing I'll say is, for the same reason we started with 6 teams and we're now at 8, we will expand. We will own venues one day, whether we build them from scratch or partner. We will have our teams in a home and away schedule environment. When that is, I think, you know, for me, the next big inflection point for lacrosse is 2028 in the Olympics. But we hope to be able to continue to move in that direction sooner.
The last thing I want to ask about the brands that you did choose was the Denver Outlaws. Were there any other MLL brands that you considered resurrecting, or did you leave some of those for future opportunities? How did that decision process unfold?
Yeah, it will. Part of the merger with MLL is the IP of the teams and all of the archival footage of games, highlights, and that's why we built our Pro Lacrosse Hall of Fame and continue to show historical stats now, where PLL stats have been integrated into MLL historical stats, all that stuff. It's like we don't really grasp how much we appreciate when we watch an NFL broadcast and we get to see Patrick Mahomes compared to Tom Brady compared to Joe Montana. Yeah. Like, that happens so regularly that it's a part of, you know, sort of the vibration of the NFL or the NBA, Major League Baseball. And so that was a big piece. Now, you know, I'm staring at a Rochester Rattlers jersey in front of me with Ned Crotty and Stefan Diggs wore a Rats jersey. We looked at all of the team brands. I would say that, you know, we have done a good job of building the 8 team brands of the PLL and want to continue to push those forward. When it came to a market like Denver, that team had been around since 2006. And they were a successful team. And an organization, to your call out earlier, we weren't recording, but we were having a conversation about you know, disparity of player treatment from, you know, in the previous regime's team ownership group to team ownership group. And Denver had some of the best treatment. It, you know, an annual game that put 30,000 people in seats on July 4th. So it's as much of a branding exercise as the Boston Cannons. It has to be the Cannons for me. If you're in Denver, it's got to be the Outlaws. And I was willing to sort of die on a sword for that.
Yeah. And it's a good brand.
It's a great brand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of the markets that didn't get teams, and that was obviously one downside of this exercise. One market that you didn't mention that has been very successful and I think is very important for kind of the future of the sport, the future of the league. You've seen it emerge as a locus of the sport is Connecticut. You guys have had some really successful weekends at Fairfield.
Yeah.
Where does that fall? And where does that fall in your mindset? And specifically with respect to New York.
Yeah.
Right? Like, can the Atlas play their home game at Fairfield? Does that fall outside of the realm of the brand?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things to that. And I'd also say that Canada is a market for us, much like, you know, the Toronto Raptors are sort of the team of Canada in the NBA.
There's a Brody Merrill Hamilton Nationals jersey behind you.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I remember those days, and they were fantastic. First the Toronto Nationals, then the Hamilton Nationals. Connecticut is an incredibly important market for us. Historically, Connecticut has not gotten the Big Four sports teams, and it's frustrating. What that has also created for us is a mapping exercise of how we can continue to take care of Connecticut fans and where they break off to being Boston Cannons fans versus New York Atlas fans. And we also have, as you mentioned, weekends to play with to be in Connecticut because it's such an important market for us. When I think about expansion and like big thinking expansion, that region will probably be cut up, right? Because upstate, Albany certainly has a stake to have a team, much like I talked about D.C., Baltimore, and Annapolis, right? You always want to have a New York City presence. It's the biggest market in the world. And then Long Island is some of the best lacrosse in the country. I think Connecticut, right? So there's a world where I would say it's 100% not ruled out. There's a world where that region of the country gets split up in expansion.
So I brought up the notion of downside or risk, and you explained the thought process that led to this. But one of the things you didn't say is that you're doing what you've said you were going to do since you launched, right?
Yeah.
This whole move to host cities is something that you have discussed for 5 years. It's not as if it was a secret. And so bringing it to fruition should be a surprise to nobody. But what were some of the other arguments against it?
Be more patient. You know,
is it restrictive to your model?
No, I don't think so, because we've learned enough, and actually our model functions better with long-term venue deals. So this gives us more incentive to structure long-term venue deals, and our schedule comes out on Jan 1, and we'll have, you know, all of the host sites ready to go. But no, I mean, honestly, if I think about your question, the only bit of feedback we got from our board and a few others that we rely on for external counsel was try to get to a level of certainty with 6 of your 8 markets. Know that teams relocate, even in the NFL. We've seen that over the last 5 years, more than ever. But make a decision that you feel as confident as possible that you don't have to relocate in the next 5 years, certain teams. And that was basically the part that we wanted to get right. And then I should say part two was, how are you going to integrate into the communities if you maintain the touring model? And we talked a little bit about how already, but those were the two sort of resistant winds.
Because it's interesting, like one of the challenges was, if I am a fan of a team and then that team moves to a market that is my blood rival, then do I have to adopt a new team? Or you know, if I am a Redwoods fan from Chicago and now they're in California, is it easy for me to be a Redwoods fan?
Yeah.
Well, how did you guys reconcile that?
Yeah, well, it's hard. We don't know. We're going to learn. But we surveyed, first of all, and we asked fans in each of those markets, markets where we were going to be in, where we weren't, what their affinity ties were like.
Yeah.
And some fans had told us that they were going to stick with their favorite team no matter where they go. And other fans told us, if my market gets a team, I'll be a fan of that. Virtually no one, I don't want to say no one definitively, but virtually no one said, I'm going to stop watching lacrosse.
Right.
And that was the bet that we had to make too, right? Because what we are unlocking is newfound interest, and we've already felt it in the first week. I mean, the announcement crushed in way of earned media.
Yeah.
We had 40 million impressions. Like, crazy number. I mean, that's a, you know, it's over $1 million in value to our brand partner in Whirlpool, who was a part of the announcement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think 2.5 million engagements. It was a huge day, and that came through earned. And that, you know, that is, by the way, those numbers I shared were owned and operated because we have access to those numbers. We're still collecting like the PMT stuff, the local media companies, but they, that unlock is for the sports fans that haven't watched professional lacrosse. And it's on us to make sure that if you are a fan of the PLL and a team of the PLL and you don't have a team now in the PLL in your market and you're trying to make a decision who to support, that's on us.
It's also an interesting evolution to the point of view on how you wanted to develop fans from the outset, because one of the main conversations was player-led affinity. And there's built into that idea the notion that you're going to switch team affinity as the players evolve, right? So if you're a Will Manny fan, you have already experienced going from being an Archers fan to a Canons fan.
Yeah.
And so the notion is, if you're a Will Manny fan from Utah, now you have to decide, am I an Archers fan or am I a Canons fan until he retires?
Yeah.
And I think that's a natural, I think it's something that'll sort itself out is kind of the way I see it.
Yeah, and you know, part of team compositions, you know, players, obviously the Maryland Whipsnakes made a lot of sense. Because 13 now, maybe 14 of those guys, but that used to be higher than that, played at University of Maryland. So part of it was team composition, but we didn't want to put too much emphasis on that, because as we have sort of deployed player movement last year and flex caps, and there's just trades, you know, and that could blow up the whole idea of putting chaos in Buffalo.
Right.
You know, just... So
it makes sense now. It may not make sense 5 years from now.
Yeah, and that's how we all, also coming back to the 32-second, is, you know, some of the most dynamic, most prolific, most celebrated, most marketable players in our sport are face-off players.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to build for the future of the game and the posterity of the game. And to me, again, the face-off position hasn't been affected. You can still win the ball forward, backward, sideways, get on, get off, score goals. Like, all of the amazing stuff about faceoff. It's actually the offense,
mm-hmm.
which to me is the waiting mechanism of the imbalance of too many possessions. And last thing I'll say on the faceoff is I've even heard the IMLCA is reviewing shortened shot clock propositions on a faceoff win. Because one of the things they learned is, like, shit, maybe we're not patient enough on a faceoff win. What the 32 exposed was to coaches going, damn, we could actually just win more draws and be more patient, slow the game down, and suffocate the other team. Mm-hmm. It's a fucking powerful position.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move on, or open up the aperture a little bit from PLL-focused to a little bit more lacrosse-focused. You and I haven't spoken about the Olympics since it became final. And, you know, I there probably aren't that many folks in the sport that have talked more publicly about the Olympics than you and me.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think?
I'm so pleased, man. It was a long process and an uncertain one. There was a lot that happened behind the scenes, but in front of it, we were working tirelessly with Jim Scher and his team and Joe Tai and his support of international lacrosse and all of the NGBs to make sure that we could all get aligned, because that was essentially the ask from Casey Washman and Kathy Carter, who run LA 28, is like, you guys just need to be aligned and put together a powerful proposal and a few other things, like it needed to be gender equal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we needed to limit the number of heads, because that's why most team sports leagues don't get into the Olympics, is there's typically like an estimated 10,000 head cap, and why you see, you know, individual sports, call it, sometimes bizarre ones, get in. And then we needed to commit to them that our pro players would play in it, and that was to your earlier question around, you know, taking 2.5, essentially 3 weeks off for the World Games, We're going to be doing that in 2028 for the Olympics. That's hard for us, but that was a commitment we needed to make. So anyway, in the end, there was a lot of what you hear similar to FIFA, IOC, like some movement that made us all really nervous. And it's true because they put five sports in. Mm-hmm. And typically the host country is capped at adding three. So the IOC came in and they were supportive of a couple disciplines, basically like, Casey, you need to bring these in. And then the process got delayed as a result. We were supposed to know
September 9th or something.
Yeah, but before that, we were supposed to know in June. Right. And I think even into late last year, we were going to get like the silent nod of last November, maybe December. Like it was just delayed and delayed. In my experience, whether it was the Amtrak this morning, if it just keeps getting delayed, get the funk out. It's not going to work. So I'm so glad that it did.
Yeah. Elevate 28 is an initiative that Mark Urquijo, the CEO of USA Lacrosse, is spearheaded to try to bring together as many stakeholders throughout the sport as possible, and kind of announced the creation of the initiative at the New York Stock Exchange late last month. You were there. And, you know, my point of view on it, and I wrote about this publicly, is that it's a public acknowledgement of something that I have felt for 6 years, roughly, in kind of an everything that rises must converge sort of way, where it's not as if there is uniform cooperation. There will always be competition. There will always be disagreements around how the best path forward looks. But it is, I have felt that stakeholders within the sport were more open to cooperation, less opposed to cooperation for the sake of it than had been the case, say, for the decade preceding it, which was, you know, basically my professional tenure in the sport. And I'm interested in your point of view on that, both from the standpoint of what does that actually look and feel like being a part of it? And then separately, why does that matter? Because I think that if you're listening to this, you might say, like, I don't really even know how much fragmentation can limit the things that we want to accomplish in the game. But you hear from both insiders and outsiders, and they say fragmentation is one of the biggest things that has prevented this thing from advancing faster than it has.
I think about that quite a bit. It's easier to say that. Logically, it makes sense. But if you look at racing, it's pretty fragmented, and they compete.
Yeah.
You have F1, NASCAR, and IndyCar.
In addition to rally, in addition to, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we could go down the list of different sports that are in certain fashions fragmented, depending on how you define it. But I think, you know, first credit to Mark Urquijo for really putting together this group. And, you know, it wasn't just a suggestion and a press release. It was meeting once a month for probably 4 or 5 months, for hours at a time. And, you know, I was pretty insistent that that needs to continue beyond the New York Stock Exchange bell ring. You know, and his predecessor, Steve Stenerson, I think wanted the same. The difference between now and then, I think, were the big commercial bodies and where the NLL was at the time, where MLL was at a time. I feel like we are now in a much different position and more mature in our view of where the sport needs to go. So we were actually capable of coming together around some of this stuff. And so I think Mark benefited from that and then also showed the foresight and fortitude to pursue it. Now, the devil in the details when it comes to participation. And one of the things we discussed and held off what was going to be a summer announcement to fall because the backdrop of the Olympics and the mostly assumption that from a marketability standpoint, it's going to become more appealing to young kids to play the game because it's an Olympic game. But in the end, we still have to execute on the way that we are allocating our time and money. And really solving for some of the challenges, right? Like I think that sticks in hands and goals on field is critical. I also think that investment into coaches is really, really important. There's a Titleist Performance Institute study that says kids drop sport for one, sometimes more, of three reasons. The first is they're not having fun, which ties to coaches mm-hmm. mostly. But, you know, a lot of times when you join teams, I joined my lacrosse team because my friends were playing. And I think privatization of sports, club teams, from what I'm gathering, is kids are bumping from team to team. There's not the camaraderie, the friendship there. So you're not having fun, is number one. Number two is you can't pick up the skill. So if you take a sport like lacrosse, hockey, or golf, hand-eye sports, even baseball, they're harder to play than soccer.
For sure.
Soccer is such a fucking beautiful game because, you know, it's a crawl, walk, run. We learn how to kick a ball before anything else. So it's universally comprehended. Lacrosse is so much more difficult. And number three is you're outsized, which goes into the age and the reclassification. And the reality is, like, some kids grow faster than others.
Yeah.
And that's really hard for the players. It's really hard for the parents.
For
parents, yeah. So So that's the type of stuff that I think about when it comes to, okay, if those are the issues, why kids turn over, how can we address those? The other element is, you know, rec related to privatization club. And it's not just lacrosse. It's soccer. It's hockey. It's basketball. And what privatization and sports specialization has done to total participation numbers, agnostic of the discipline. When we all grew up,
played multiple sports.
At least three. I played four sports a year. I played one sport per season. And every one of those sports counted me as a participant. So just from a math standpoint, as people sports specialize, you're out three opportunities per kid. So I think it kind of reminds me of like the cord cutting in broadcast cable. Like, it's more of a reconciliation of an acute player, someone who's passionate about the sport. Those are where participation numbers are. You know, cable has gone from 110 million homes to 70. The industry that hasn't been affected is sports. Sports are actually increasing their ratings, but entertainment viewers who are subscribing to the bundle and news consumers, they're off and they're on to streaming. So it's been a reconciliation of sports fans on the broadcast cable. And I think sports specialization has been a reconciliation of like true participants. Now I don't want to just accept that. I want to help revive rec and town. I want to figure out the best ways to invest, to get sticks in hands. Is that, you know, without the Titleist Performance Institute material, I would say for me, before I can fall in love with anything, I need to try it. And if the prospect of trying lacrosse included a registration fee that was in the realm of five figures to buying my own equipment, which I got my equipment on loan from Played Against Sports, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have tried lacrosse. I wouldn't have fell in love with it. So we certainly have a unique challenge given all the aforementioned, but we've got to think about allowing more people to try it. Like, the organic approach always wins.
My point of view on that, and I agree with your point about investing in coaches, is recruiting current scholastic coaches of other non-spring sports and training them how to coach lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially if you're in a school, I think your ability to recruit from your team and the other kids in the hall is more powerful and way more efficient than anything else that you can do in terms of trying to get sticks in hands. Because, and also the difference between, you know, a scholastic season versus a rec season, and obviously you're starting later in life if that is the point of investment you're trying to make, but you know, you basically get a kid for a couple months, as opposed to one or two practices, and then they decide it's not for them.
Totally. I mean, look, going back to the three reasons why kids stop playing, the governing bodies are responsible for the size discrepancies in age and reclassifications. Mm-hmm. The governing bodies need to do that. So when it comes to coaches, their impact on whether or not a kid has fun largely has to do with the kid's ability to acquire skill mm-hmm. for a difficult sport. And if they're not great coaches, that learning curve is going to be really steep.
For sure.
And they're not going to have the skill, they're not going to have fun, and they're out. So it is actually the backdoor pathway to doubling participation, I think, in the end. If there's something that I can invest in now, it's coaches, even over sticks and hands and goals on field.
Transitioning a little bit more, I didn't have this on the list of questions that I was prepared for, but you made a couple comments that sprung it to mind. College lacrosse, and specifically college lacrosse in an era of realignment and NIL, much different from the sport that you played mm-hmm. on that mm-hmm. standpoint. And in most other respects, it's pretty similar. What's your point of view on college lacrosse right now?
I think that they should do a 60-second shot clock. And I think that, I mean, talk about coaches. They have great coaches, fantastic players. Players are better than they ever have been in the sort of modern era of lacrosse. And then maybe the other thing is, I think the transfer portal is more valuable than recruiting. That's what it seems to me, with NIL and the widespread acceptance of transferring being okay. Meaning that, you know, you have a choice of, without a surefire five-star top 100 recruit, which that's capped, you're betting on someone's skill acclimation and personality acclimation, where it's in a transfer portal, it's more of a sure thing.
Yeah.
Those are probably like off-the-cuff reactions to college lacrosse right now.
Let's shift back to talking about PLL as we wind this down and be respectful of your time. It's a great answer. It's just I'm really interested. I've always been interested in your point of view on college lacrosse because you're a pro lacrosse guy. And yeah. But at the same time, you won two championships and competed at the highest level. The notion that you wouldn't be as or more invested in college lacrosse than anybody else is easily disabused.
Yeah.
But it's just – it's not preeminent for you because you have this other thing.
I'm not pushing it as much.
For yeah, sure.
That's fair and good feedback for me. I mean, I love the college game. And I think that, you know, we can – we actually devise – ideas and rules around the great stuff about college sports. I mean, you take again and look at basketball as a cross examination. I mean, what makes college basketball so exciting is every position is about like pride and living and dying, and there's full court presses and half court traps and all that stuff. One of the happy accidents of the 32 is, man, I've never seen pros ride like this. So, and I didn't think there was enough conversation around, you know, the Water Dogs and the Cannons did this so well. They'd lose a draw, they'd immediately sprint into a deep ride. I mean, attackmen were flying all over the place because they knew that if they rode harder for another 3 seconds, that would take the total clock from 32 to 29,
yeah.
Right? And stuff like that. And so the pro game is actually, to me, more than ever, at the level of sort of effort and care that the college game was. And that was something when I was playing MLL coming out of college, it was something I knew I could control, which was my care and effort in the pro game, despite all the other shit. And I wanted to help with Mike create an environment where that was a lot easier for guys coming out of college and the pros to do.
Yeah. Like I said, shifting back to PLL as we wind this down. You know, kind of a combination of forward-looking and backward-looking. Next meter rights deal.
Yeah.
So you're in year three of a four-year deal with ESPN. I know that there's a lot that you probably can't talk about, but what can you tell us about what year three means in terms of setting the table for renegotiation and what an extension might look like or, you know, what it might look like if it goes back out to market?
Yeah, it's huge. Year two was huge. We were up 36% year over year in broadcast viewership, 60% in total viewership on ESPN+. We had 8 ABC windows and another 8 divided between ESPN and ESPN2. And we spent a lot of time marketing tune in to games and a lot of effort and a lot of resource. We want to level that up this year. And when you asked me about what 2023 was, I said growth. Now that, part of growing is being able to, through post-mortem, establish and see what worked and then pour more resources onto what worked and less on what didn't. I think you called it, right? We're going to begin negotiations for a renewal in the next year. They typically, media rights deals typically take 12 to 18 months to get done. And so, you know, Mike and I were running around town with our head on fire when we were launching the PLL because we were private and we also needed a media rights deal and we didn't have time. So I think, you know, time's on our side. The sport is on our side. The performance of the PLL is on our side. ESPN is on our side. The promotion that they give us and the promotion that they have and the sort of like the above and beyond effort they've put into things from a marketing standpoint, from a visibility standpoint, even on Plus, has just been extraordinary. And I believe firmly as a, like a student of media, that Disney and their value proposition for sports, starting with ESPN, is the most robust on the market, all the way through owned and operated social. They've just figured it all out really well. And there's other stuff that they're sorting through now, but that to me is a great home for us, and I hope to build a future with them.
You know that I can't let you out of here without asking at least one tough question.
Okay.
There was a report.
I feel like
there was a.
You've done a great job, man. I'm the one just like, you know, going all over the place.
There was a report earlier this year in front office sports about Netflix looking to acquire PLL, setting the table for what this means for the future of PLL. I don't even know if I've seen you publicly comment on that report. Were there conversations, and what would future ownership look like? Because I think there's been a lot of thought or conversation around franchise ownership.
Yeah.
But what does that mean from a league entity structure standpoint, particularly when, you know, whether it be MLS or WNBA, we've seen different structures emerge for, you know, team sports leagues that have a trade association model or have a single entity model, but then also the way that that then evolves as enterprise value grows.
Yeah. Well, look, we're in the business of growing attention and consumption in the PLL, driving revenue and driving a return to all of our shareholders, which include our players. And the stakeholders benefit from the shareholders' returns. And we're a true single entity league. We're a team sports league, but we function more like the UFC, the WWE, which are owned by Endeavor and now public under TKO, and F1, which is owned by Liberty Media.
Yeah.
So the value proposition has always been sort of two-pronged in that if there is a suitable acquirer that comes with a roadmap of increasing what I had talked about, visibility and commercial opportunity, then we would explore that. And there are different stages of which you could define M&A. But
yeah, one of the things that I didn't like about the lacrosse fan reaction to that report was it almost seemed like there was this assumption that Reed Hastings was going to be the one running PLL. Whereas, like, no, that's a the gap between acquisition and management is, or ownership and management is very, very, there's a million different ways in which that apple can be sliced.
Yeah, I mean, people forget at one point Disney owned the Anaheim Mighty Ducks and the Anaheim Angels. Yeah, it's the Anaheim Angels.
Well, now it's the California Angels of Anaheim.
Yeah, well, they own a baseball team and a hockey team, right? And they did well with the baseball team, struggled more with the hockey team. But they came in and owned teams in a trade association, to your point. And the challenge was like, hey, Disney had this huge value proposition vehicle, their IP, especially out in California. And they did things like, you know, bring the Mighty Ducks to Disneyland and do all these like cross-promotional stuff. But they were still challenged by the restriction of the commissioner's suite and the trade association. And
I mean, more recently, I think that's one of the things that you saw when it comes to essentially the divestiture of the Philadelphia 76ers from, you know, the Fanatic stakeholder as they move into a sports gaming situation.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And you're talking about Michael Rubin, who's now building his $40 billion business called Fanatics across the different sectors of sports media and thereby conflicted him out of owning a team. You know, the second path is, as you had mentioned, selling teams to franchise owners. And we can do that by maintaining single entity status like Don Garber and the MLS has done, or we can restructure altogether. And both of them, both of those outcomes are valuable to shareholders and stakeholders. We continue to have conversations because we have to. No business trades without them and without putting it on your calendar and trying to work toward it. I do believe that an event that happens either through an organization that I had mentioned or a media company that I had mentioned or on the latter would unlock a lot of value for the PLL. It's just a matter of making sure the timing is right. The standards are set. The commitment is there over a long period of time. And then your last thing to your point is, like, you know, CAA just sold for in the tune of like $8 billion or something. And they keep the operating team on. They keep the management. They do what's called earnouts. Mm-hmm. And if a media company were to ever buy the PLL, what media companies don't do right now is operate leagues. So it would come with a lot of papering around operations. This is something that we do really well. And that's under Andrew Sinnenberg, who's our COO, we've done quite a good job on tour. So a media company will want to capture the upside value of lacrosse, do things like invest in ancillary programming to support the game's growth when it's alive.
Yeah.
And then make sure that they don't fuck up with operations.
Last one. 5 years. What are you most proud of, and what's your biggest regret?
I might give what would be considered a trite answer on regret. I just don't believe in regret.
Well, then let me ask it this way. Is there anything that you would have done differently?
Yeah.
Or what is one thing you would have done differently?
Sort of the same thing. But let me explain. Like the most important game of my college career was losing the national championship my senior year to Syracuse. I fucking hated losing that game. It was devastating, and I still look back in a way of vain and around what I've done and what I've accomplished. And I would love to have won that game, but it spurred my professional career. You know, I had so much motivation coming off of that, and losing the Tourton as well, and so it's become one of the most valuable pieces. As was breaking my foot. You know, which was the first major injury that set me back. And then I was traded from Boston to New York. And we had a fantastic campaign in 2015 and won the MLL championship. And I had one of my best seasons. 2020 happened in the bubble. I played like shit. And I had one of my best seasons the following year. So in our business, when we launched really fast in year one, we outsourced ticket sales. It was really hard. But we learned that was the wrong decision so that we could build a really great ticket sales team with amazing leaders, like this guy Danny Passavoy, who runs our ticketing department. And we've seen tremendous growth year over year. So there are always learnings, and it tends to be, in my experience, the biggest mistakes that we make are the moments that set the stage for our biggest success.
And what are you most proud of?
Just proud of the team, you know, everyone that commits year round to building the PLL. Sometimes I feel like a broken record. I know I can speak for Mike as well that, you know, we have these weekly all hands meetings and we have people who work at the PLL all over the country. So it's virtual, it's in dual offices in LA and New York. And we talk about what we've accomplished. We give out weekly awards. We talk about what's next. We motivate. And, you know, I'm so proud of everyone because we go through our best season yet, finish September 21st. We have our PLL Academy events in October, but really like on background, just building for this release in November of what we were internally dubbing Project Next. And then like the 2 weeks leading into it, it felt like 2018 and we were launching again. And so we're just deep into the weeds and like pushing people again, working late nights, working weekends to make sure we get this right. And there's motivation behind it. And then boom, we have a fantastic release. And now it's like, okay, merchandise, right? That business unit leader, Daniel Ortiz, and his team are approaching Black Friday deals and holiday deals. And it's our job as a team, right? Offense, defense, special teams to support merch. And so then the ask is back out to everyone to think critically and creatively. And then when we turn the holiday, it's going to be the Champ Series. And when the Champ Series is over, it's going to be the next season. So it's just relentless work. And feel really inspired and proud of the people who work at the PLL.
Paul Rabel, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, man. I enjoyed it. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.